That puts us in Proverbs chapter 6. You notice just in the sequence of things that we gathered material from both the end of chapter 6 and all of chapter 7 earlier. Last couple of weeks, we were on one theme that's dealt with in chapters 5 and the second half of 6 and all of chapter 7, trying to draw all of that together. But we really need to return to the first portion of chapter 6 if we're going to cover all the material. And chapter 6, in the first 15 verses, really addresses three topics that seem in one really distinct from one another. Three topics that divide up like this. Verses 1 to 5, give counsel. And here's the outline. Verses 1 to 5, give counsel to free yourself if you have entered into a particular kind of rash commitment. Namely, binding yourself with a promise to cover for what really ought to be someone else's responsibility. We'll talk specifically about what seems to be described there. I'm just giving you an outline. First five verses seem to touch on that topic. Secondly, we have verses 6 to 11. They encourage initiative, and they warn against idleness. And from those verses come the very, very famous words, go to the ant, you sluggard. So we'll deal with those. Those are pretty famous in Proverbs. And then verses 12 to 15 speak of someone who seems bent on scheming and plotting and deceiving, and simply says, disaster looms over you, you know, if that's the case. So it's interesting. Blocks of ideas. Boom, boom, boom. 1, 2, 3 in these verses. In one sense, we could have gone to verses 16 to 19 as well, but I think perhaps that it's not separated from the others, but it's one that I'd like to give more attention to on its own, verses 16 to 19. So we've got three things, three relatively independent subjects today. The number one, this is the outline, the problem, of promising to cover for what really ought to be someone else's responsibility. Number two, an encouragement to initiative and a warning against idleness. And number three, that disaster looms over the deceitful schemer. I think you've heard me say here in this, in talking about the nature of this book, that the matters of wisdom described in Proverbs are at their core not just matters of having a little more information, not just matters of skill or savvy, but very consistently they are matters of the heart. They relate deeply to the matter of knowing God, giving Him proper respect, being willing to be corrected, knowing, loving, doing what is good. And so when I come up on any topic, I want to think of it in that context, that framework of thinking. It's been pretty consistent throughout the book. What we are warned of in Proverbs is not just plain ignorance, not just lack of savvy, but we're warned about a departure from principles that concern what is good and right and just and fair and in accord with who God is and what His purposes are. In today's set of three topics for that outline, it's not too hard to see how it relates to moral issues for the third one, a warning against the deceitful schemer. That's pretty obvious. Perhaps it's not too hard to see in warnings against sloth. And you know, maybe that's not too hard to see. What about that bit of making rash commitment in this particular category? I think even then, the issue is not just limited to issues practical. It's not going to go very well if you do that. You know, it's not just issues practical. I think stewardship comes into play. And really, also, perhaps, it has to do with how human beings get along and what kinds of things can ruin how human beings get along. And so I think it's presenting those kinds of things as well. It depicts what you can expect to see in an imperfect world. And the fact that sometimes even what may be a genuine desire to show a kindness may not in fact serve the person as well in the end, if it is indeed in accord with this model. So we'll talk about all of those things. Let's read Hebrews. Hebrews. Where did that come from? Proverbs. You're going to worry about me here shortly. Proverbs 6, 1 to 15. My son, if you've put up security for your neighbor, if you've struck hands in pledge for another, if you've been trapped by what you said, ensnared by the words of your mouth, then do this, my son, to free yourself. Since you've fallen into your neighbor's hands, go and humble yourself, press your plea with your neighbor, allow no sleep to your eyes, no slumber to your eyelids, free yourself like a gazelle from the hand of the hunter, like a bird from the snare of the fowler. Point one. You know, number two, go to the ant, you sluggard, consider its ways, and be wise. It has no commander, no overseer or ruler yet. It stores its provisions in summer and gathers its food at harvest. How long will you lie there, you sluggard? When will you get up from your sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come on you like a bandit, and scarcity like an armed man. Number two. Number three. A scoundrel and villain who goes about with a corrupt mouth, who winks his eye, signals with his feet, and motions with his fingers, who plots evil and deceit in his heart. He always stirs up dissension. Therefore, disaster will overtake him. In an instant, he will suddenly be destroyed without remedy. So these are blocks, you know, it seems to me. I'm trying to sort it out. I think it's just blocks of teaching. So we have three of them to reflect upon. So back to this matter of putting up security. My son, if you have put up security for your neighbor, do you feel like you understand what is being described there? What is the issue? What, practically speaking, what's been done and what is he, you know, instructing you to work with and get out of? The topic, interestingly, comes up about six times altogether in Proverbs. It's mentioned those times. And the scenario seems to be this. That someone, a neighbor, it says, someone who is seeking to deal with a lender or a landlord or entering into some kind of contract obligation for goods or services promised is trying to get that set up with another party, but the party with whom they are dealing with does not feel certain that the individual will be able to meet his obligations. And that's where you come in. Or perhaps should not come in. That suppose that the lender or the landlord or the merchant or employer or whatever could be persuaded to allow the first person to enter into the contract if you commit to meet all obligations if they default. That, I think, is what's being described here. A promise to fulfill obligations if the other defaults. I think that's the thing. And again, that comes up a number of times throughout the book. Every time it comes up here and elsewhere, the book shouts, risk, danger, be careful. and it seems to mark an understanding of how things tend to go in the world, teaching us this one usually doesn't go well. Be careful. Chapter 11, verse 15 says, he who puts up security for another will surely suffer. So we're hearing this instruction. Again, it seems to recognize a reality in our imperfect world. See, I could really very easily envision the motivation behind the person putting up the security, making the promise to meet the obligation if so-and-so defaults. I can absolutely envision that as a kindness. Let's say a desire. I better describe it in terms of a desire for a kindness. I have no problem envisioning that. But I hear the instruction, this usually doesn't go well. And I think we begin to learn. Our passage has used the word trapped. Our passage has used the word ensnared. Falling into the hands of. And again, it talks about sparing no effort to get out. It seems as though that arrangement lends itself to the worst of the expected possible scenarios. The agreement gets made. One could imagine various ways in which that might play itself out, but probably the worst of those will play itself out. I think that's what I hear the passage saying. Be careful here. This doesn't usually go well. Human nature has not shown itself very honorable here. And although it is not said directly in this text, I wonder if an underlying principle could be described like this. It doesn't generally actually help the person to enable them not to face the responsibilities that are really theirs. Now, that's not said directly, but I've wondered if that's part of this picture. The sort of human nature likely outcome is that the person will default. Perhaps, and again, I'm posing things in terms of perhaps. Perhaps because the urgency of entering into their responsibility has been diminished by this action. And I think many of us would know either by experience, I ask you to think about this. Do you know either by experience or by knowing a situation like this? That it can be ruinous in relationship between people, this scenario. By way of application, I think in one sense, the healthiest thing for anybody is to grapple with their own responsibilities. That's the healthiest thing, to face them as they are. And to hear from a passage like this, that even, I have no trouble thinking of this as a motivation of kindness, but even this may not serve them. May not serve them the best. I don't want any of this teaching to shut down generosity. You know what I'm saying? I don't want any of this teaching to shut down generosity. But perhaps straight out gifts are better than the practice of pledging to cover defaults. A straight out gift, better than this. This is a setup for difficulty, it would seem. And again, it instructs us, if you realize that you have been trapped by what you've committed yourself to, I hear it saying, start the efforts to get out. You know, don't let yourself rest until you get out. Shoulder the embarrassment, go face to face, and plead with the release from your stated obligation. One thing I notice about this is it holds giving your word in very high regard. It doesn't say, if you're into this, just default. It says your word stands. Deal with it in that manner. Go face to face and interact. So you got to shoulder the harness of it. What does it say? Humble yourself? Humble yourself. Yes, press your plea. Be urgent about it. But it requires a humbling of yourself to go. So some things for context to think about what was instructed there. worth talking about, I think. Doesn't this come up all the time? Stuff like this comes up all the time. And we've heard an instruction. How do we process that? It'd be worth talking about. Let's move on to the instructions that begin, go to the ant. Go to the ant. By the way, what is the warning there? It's an instruction to learn, and it's a warning. What is the content of the warning? Poverty will come like a bandit. Scarcity like an armed man. I mean, I think if I'm analyzing the analogy rightly, it will sneak up on you. It will come unexpectedly, suddenly there, and there in a powerful way, like the disproportion of strength when somebody holds up a gun and says, I want your wallet. You know, an armed bandit. It's sudden and it's overpowering. Poverty will come, scarcity like an armed man. God has worked ordinary kinds of consequences into his system. And I think Solomon is saying here, you can expect to see surprise scarcity if you don't attend to these instructions. What does the passage commend to us? Because the passage does both. It commends to us something and warns. It commends initiative. I think it sets, and I want to say this clearly, but I think it sets before us a very vibrant way to live, a calling. It says this is God's world. This is what it's meant to look like, a calling. And this would be a call to initiative, not always needing to be prodded by an overseer all the time. Go to the ant, it says. And again, I think in the context of the whole book, the wisdom versus foolishness, I think we may presume that the foolishness here is also an ungodliness, not operating in accord with God, what God made you for. Made us for taking his resources and entering into them with initiative and going and not having to be prodded all the time. This subject comes up 11 times in the book. The other one came up 6 times. I'm not sure we're supposed to do percentage ratings, you know, like that, but it comes up 11 times in the book. And I think of it in terms like this. Jesus likened serving in God's kingdom in our lives here on earth to having been entrusted with God's property. Matthew 25:1, the kingdom of heaven, he said, will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his property to them. We were saying earlier, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof and all the riches in it are his. It is a stewardship matter, entrusted with good things and good prospects to enter in with this vibrance and initiative. I think the ant illustration is just golden. Because you know how ants operate. Right? Because you have seen this. I think that's the choice. I think there's a certain poetic irony choosing an insect and a small one at that. Right? There's a certain get you right here kind of a thing about choosing that insect. But we know how they operate. I was preaching through all of these things about 11 years ago here. And I remember a certain just experience as I was preparing. Something took me down to Fresno Pacific that day. I don't know if it was like a promote the church at the school thing, but I happened to be on location at Fresno Pacific, and I was sitting at a picnic table eating a muffin and thinking about all of this, right? And I saw two ants there on my picnic table. And I thought to myself, you know, don't their movements look random? Don't they look so random? And I just crawled on the table and I thought, what if I put a crumb from my muffin way over there, you know? And I did it. Put my crumb over there. But then I'm thinking about it and I forgot about my whole illustration and I just put it over there, right? Random little movements. And I really did forget about it. And not long afterward, what did I see? Well, you know exactly what I saw, right? A line. up to the thing. And it's fascinating. And you don't see anyone in that sitting on the outside of that line going, oh, whatever. I'm not doing that. And you don't see any drill sergeant getting on someone's case and get back in the, you know, the thing. They don't have any commander. This is in the warp and the woof of who they are, or what they are as creatures in the world. This is right in them. This to do this is just born into them. And I'm thinking, you know, I can understand ant number one. He's wandering around. When he finds it, how do ant numbers 2 through 15 through 25 through 40 find it? You know. My natural reaction would be, this is just a creature. He hasn't got a brain. Well, it has a brain, but you know what I'm saying? It's just a creature. I'm thinking he's going to find the crumb. I'll be right here next to the crumb. I'm not thinking about planning. I'm not thinking about storing things away. I'm not thinking about the community. I'm not thinking about any of that. I'm just here at the crumb. I'll be eating until I can't stand up. You know? But it's not that way. And by God's inspiration, Solomon says, Learn even from that creature. Even they may look random, but even they store up. Even if you can't think of the science that makes that happen, where ant number one tells ant number two, and they know where to come, and they line up and they come. Even if you can't figure that out, learn from them, plan ahead and engage. And without an overseer coming in all the time in that manner. I hope that these kind of words are also inspiration and not just name calling, you sluggard. You know, I don't mean I hope that he's written it that way. I think it is inspiration as well, but I hope we receive it as saying, oh, what a vibrant way to live, to engage and show initiative and not lie around as a sluggard. Let's go to the last segment. It begins with the words a scoundrel and a villain. I think it's worthwhile to spend a little time on the Hebrew word scoundrel. Or it's actually two words. The Hebrew for that is Adam, which means a man. Adam Belial, which means a person of no profit, a person from whom comes no worth, no good. It's the equivalent of saying a no good and a villain. That's just the literal, you know, translated out thing, a no good and a villain. Have you ever associated the idea of sin with the absence of worth? We are meant for God's glory. When we turn against Him and go ways that are damaging, ways that are hostile, plotting, planning, deceitful, again, against other persons, this whole description of Him is that He is plotting, scheming against other persons, always stirring up dissension, those kinds of things. It comes, there is nothing of worth in it. It is for nothing. God spoke that way once when He pronounced judgment on the behavior of the Israelites during the time of the kings. 2 Kings 17, 13 to 15 reads this way. The Lord warned Israel and Judah through all His prophets and seers, turn from your evil ways. Observe my commands and decrees in accordance with the entire law that I commanded your fathers to obey and that I delivered to you through my servants the prophets, but they would not listen and were as stiff-necked as their fathers. They did not trust in the Lord their God. They rejected His decrees and the covenant He had made with their fathers and the warnings He had given them. They followed worthless idols and themselves became worthless. And I think that goes beyond just the worthlessness of a stand-up carved image. He had commanded them to keep His law, which is of great, great worth, and they became worthless. The designation Adam Belial forms a part of what we're learning about the relationship between wisdom and the knowledge of God. And I've said here that there's no wisdom apart from the knowledge and respect for the Lord, and neither is there any worth. People do things because they think they see worth in them. Some satisfaction, some pleasure, some benefit. And they plot against others for the same reason as this one does. But it is for nothing. For nothing. It is Belial, however you can pronounce that more properly than I just did. That term, it's interesting. That term comes to the Greek New Testament kind of directly from the Hebrew. Some words do that. They cross over language to language, some more directly than others, and that one does. Listen to its use in 2 Corinthians 6:14. What do righteousness and wickedness have in common? Or what fellowship can light have with darkness? What harmony is there between Christ and Belial? See, that's a word that came directly across. Do you know what, to whom is that a reference? That's a nickname, if you will, for Satan himself. No good, no worth. And so, who's being described to us here? A no worth and villain goes about with corrupt mouth, winks his eye, signals with his feet, motions with his fingers, who plots evil, deceit in his heart, always stirs up dissension, and therefore, it says, disaster will overtake him in an instant. I think there are two things going on there. I think in Proverbs especially, there is an immediate reference to earthly disaster. You could expect to see that in the world. But I think it runs deeper than that, and throughout the whole of the word, it runs deeper than that. There is an ultimate disaster in the end. And it's highlighted over and over again. Let me read from 1 Thessalonians 5:2-3. The day of the Lord, that'd be the judgment day of the Lord. The day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night while people are saying peace and safety. Destruction will come on them suddenly, and they will not escape. I think a brief passage like that reminds us of the core issues once again, back to keeping the main thing, that we, you know, the beginning of knowledge is the knowledge of the Lord and the fear of the Lord, the proper respect for the Lord. We do not want to be persons over whose heads looms immediate surprise disaster. Very especially the immediate surprise disaster of the final judgment and end of all things. So I think these things speak to both. Speak of immediate, yes, you don't be surprised in the world when someone's life falls apart in an instant under those circumstances. But I think it touches more deeply even than that. And the next section, which we're not going to deal with in depth now, makes a list. You know, there are six things the Lord hates, seven things that are detestable to him. And I just think if there are things the Lord hates, we need to deal with that and find his mercy of forgiveness for those things we've participated in, repent and turn from them, and go find his redemption in Christ. Again, the book of Proverbs functions just like the law to drive us to Christ.